So what I've been working with, and I'll try and make this work on several different levels, is I've been working with a text called the Heart Sutra here, which is one of the core texts in Buddhism. It's very pithy, but it contains within itself really all the essential elements of what one would need to know if they were interested in Buddhism as such. But equally importantly, it contains the core elements of what you would want to know if you wanted to learn how to meditate effectively, if you wanted to gain some control over your own mind or your own emotional state, which is often why people want to meditate. So it's valuable on multiple levels, not just because, hey, I'm a Buddhist and I want to know this. And most of us aren't, so that's not the reason why we could be interested. So the good thing about it is it's really short. It's just about a couple paragraphs long. The bad thing about it is the entirety of the Buddhist worldview is packed into those couple of paragraphs. So that's the bad thing, because you can imagine that every line has extraordinary dimension and depth to it. One of the reasons that I'm working with this text is that a number of us are students of a Tibetan Lama called Zachuje, who comes to Yakima every once in a while. And when we went to visit with him in the spring, we'd felt, even though we'd been doing classes here in Le Grand for about 4 years, we felt some change was required. We didn't exactly know what it was, but we felt that in that environment it would become clearer what we needed to do. And it did. And that's one of the reasons we're meeting in this environment now. And one of the reasons for working with this text, because he did a series of teachings on the wisdom tradition in Buddhism. And that's really what this text, the Heart Sutra, is about, the wisdom tradition in Buddhism. And it's kind of interesting that it's called the Heart Sutra, because we tend to think that understanding is in our heads, which a certain kind of understanding is in our brains and in our heads, whatever's going on up there. But most traditional cultures, including Buddhist cultures, will say, no, wisdom comes from your heart. And in other parts of the world, and traditionally in other parts of the world, if somebody said something about themselves and they pointed to themselves, unlike Americans who would kind of like point at their head, in the traditional societies, people would point at their chest, probably, or maybe even a little bit lower, but they certainly wouldn't point up there. I mean, no Native American speaking self-referentially would have pointed at their noggin. That would have not happened. It's not the way they thought about things. I'm pretty sure anyway, based upon what I learned. So the Heart Sutra is the heart of wisdom, but it's also wisdom that comes from the heart. And it's a story about, it is sort of a story. I mean, the Buddha is sitting and meditating with some of his disciples, and one disciple asks a question of the other disciple. The Buddha doesn't actually say anything in the beginning, even though it's a Buddhist scripture. One disciple asks a question of another disciple, and I could sort of imagine these guys sitting under trees someplace. We actually know where this thing took place. And at one time it was very lush, although we visited it, and now it's not very lush. It's in an area of northeast India, which has been deforested, but in the Buddha's time it was very lushly forested, very rich land. India at that time was a very, very rich country with food surpluses. That's the reason there could be Buddhist monks wandering around and other kinds of mendicants. And were taken care of by the society, because society did have food surplus because it was so wealthy. Possibly one of the wealthiest parts of the world at that point. Anyway, so there's this conversation that's going on. And the place where I want to pick up on this conversation, because in earlier talks, we were in earlier parts, parts of the conversation. One of the disciples is called Avalokiteshvara, and the other one's called Shariputra. And so Avalokiteshvara asked Shariputra, how should any noble son or noble daughter who wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom train? It's clumsy English. But if you wanted to train in wisdom, how would you do it? That's what the question is. And what I wanted to talk about a little bit tonight was the answer. And I'll probably talk about it when we continue this, which will be in a month, because we're going on vacation. But we'll meet again in a month. We'll meet again the third Sunday. The third Sunday of July.
So not the first Sunday.
This time, correct. Okay. Right. So, Shariputra well, here, I'll just read it. When this has been said, the holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, blah, blah, spoke to the venerable Shariputra. So here's the answer. He says, Shariputra, any noble son or noble daughter who so wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom should clearly see this way. They should see perfectly that even the five aggregates are empty of intrinsic existence. Now, to say even the five aggregates are empty of intrinsic existence, which will not make any sense at the moment, if I were to do a proper job of explaining that, it would take about 40 hours. I mean, that's where it's at. The idea of empty, to say that something is empty of intrinsic existence, is a very important concept in Buddhist thought, and actually has practical ramifications. And what the five aggregates are is also important. What is being said here is that the components of a person, the elements, as we would say, of a personality, the parts of a personality that make up a person, those are the five aggregates, are not what they appear to be. And that's when he says they're empty of intrinsic existence. What he's saying is that everything that we think about ourselves, how we function, the way our consciousness works, the way our bodies work, the way we exist in relationship to the environment, is erroneous. I mean, we go around thinking we understand what's going on. If we're scientists, we know we have a limited understanding, which we can develop over time. And we, in some sense, know where our limitations are. The Buddhists really were clued into this a long time ago, but they saw it really deeply. And they saw it deeply in the sense that they understood that people have certain ideas about what's going on around them that are erroneous about their own nature, about what's going on in the world around them. So you're an agricultural scientist, and you know that the way people used to think about farming techniques was sometimes real and practical, but there were a lot of things that they simply didn't understand because they didn't have the tools to understand things in certain ways. And if they believed that the way you could get crops to grow really well was to sacrifice a horse, and that would cause the crops to grow really well, which is what people used to believe, that really wasn't going to do it. You know, that there'd be something else that might be required. But people believed that in the same way that people believed the world was flat, because it's obvious that the world's flat. But it took something more to begin to realize that, no, that wasn't the truth of the matter. So when the Buddhists say that things are empty, what they're saying is that things are empty or lacking of what you think is there, that you've projected concepts or you've projected ideas into something that are probably erroneous. Let me be even more specific about this. I'm reading a book now, and it's called Incognito. It's written by a neuroscientist. And he's talking about the nature of perception and talking about all the perceptual errors we make on a regular basis that we're completely unaware of our making. That basically most of what we're conscious of, according to the neuroscientists, most of what we're conscious of has very little to do with what's actually going on inside of us and around us, and is often quite erroneous. And if we're making decisions based on those erroneous ideas, we're not likely to have really good outcomes. So the Buddhist wisdom tradition is about finding a way to see more accurately what's going on. And so they assert that you actually can do this. If you couldn't do this, there would be no point in any Buddhist teaching, because it'd be, okay, we're confused, end of story. We got to live with it. Things aren't going to get any better. Go have a beer. Why worry about it, right? You know. But as it turns out, they say, no, there is something you can do about it, because you can get control over the thought processes which are presumably telling you what's going on, and you can sort of hold them aside so that you can see directly what's happening apart from your thoughts about what's happening. And if you can do that, and that process is called meditation, if you can do that, then you can see more truthfully what's actually happening. And then you can make informed, correct decisions rather than uninformed, erroneous decisions. So the relationship between Buddhist thought, such as what I'm speaking of here, and meditation practice is, first off, to get the idea out there that there's a problem with most of your ideas, which is kind of interesting in itself. That leads to an interesting paradox, doesn't it, if you think about it? We're not going to go there tonight. But you can learn about the errors of thinking that you're making which cover up reality, and then you can learn to hold your mind aside so you can see things more directly. Sort of my favorite example of this came out of a class that I was teaching at EOU. And even though it was an online class, I was essentially talking about this sort of thing in either a lecture that I wrote down or that I audio recorded. I can't remember which. And I said something like, oh, well, you know, a lot of people think that when they get married, they're going to live happily ever after. And just find the right person and everything's going to be fantastic, because Hollywood movies and, you know, everything else, and Vogue magazine, well, maybe not Vogue magazine, but, you know, a lot of these magazines are trying to convince us that's true. So we all know, because we're older, that, you know, marriage is wonderful and a lot of work, and it's not happily ever after unless you apply yourself to the problems that come up in marriage, which requires getting out of your own way half the time, and, you know, a whole lot of other complicated stuff. And I had a student in the class who said something like, oh boy, yeah, you know, I got married and I believed the whole thing and had a $20,000 wedding and the gown and the whole routine. And she said, it blew everything up. The very thought that I had that I was going to live happily ever after if I had the perfect marriage, because somehow she had that in her mind. If she had not the perfect marriage, but the perfect wedding ceremony. You know, if she fulfilled that fantasy of having the perfect wedding ceremony and everybody was happy, everything would get off on the right foot, then she'd live happily ever after. And she said basically what happened was she put herself in so much debt, it stressed her and her husband out for so much time to deal with this, because they had to pay for a lot of it themselves, that it actually undermined her own marriage. And so she got the way, and she shared this with the rest of the class, she got the way in which her ideas and her fantasies about reality actually undermined reality. So it was a really great example that she shared with the class, and we do a lot of that. And we can't help but do a lot of that, because it's what our minds do. As Zachoje says, I thought it was really wonderful the way he said this, he said, the job of our mind is to tell us stories. And it'll never stop telling us stories, no matter what. The mind will never stop telling us stories. It's like the kidneys. They're never going to stop excreting the stuff they're supposed to excrete. That's their job, you know. So let them do it, you know. Go to the bathroom once in a while. Don't worry about it. It's what they're supposed to do. Said, your mind will make up stories, but you have a choice. You're going to believe the stories or you're not going to believe the stories, but it will continue to generate stories. So what are you going to do about that? He said, so what you do about that is you pay attention to the stories as stories rather than paying attention to the stories as the truth. And sometimes there are stories that are good stories that will inform you about what's going on in a certain way. And sometimes there are stories that are just completely useless, like if I just have the perfect wedding, life will be wonderful and I'll live happily ever after and I don't have to worry about paying the bills. So, the idea of emptiness, which comes up in Buddhist thought a lot, the idea of emptiness is sort of like saying, this cup is full of something, stories, if you will, or ideas about things, and if you can empty it of that stuff, then in the empty space that remains, you can see what's really going on. You see the actual nature of the cup when it's empty of whatever's in it. On the other hand, when you see what's in it, you know its function as a cup. And so there's actually a kind of a complexity to the issue of what's there and what's not there. And I think that that's actually, for the evening, a good place to stop, is with that kind of cliffhanger. You call it a cliffhanger, you know? Sort of introduce emptiness and the idea that it's about withdrawing projections, that it's about withdrawing this and
being a participant in the sense of changing the direction of what there is.
So, do you want to know what the Buddhist view is about changing the direction of what's going on? What's that?
Any kind of response you'd like to give, whether it's Buddhist or your own or
synthesis of things. Or right. Whatever. Well, they're the same thing. My own view is, after so many years, pretty much a Buddhist view. I think my view would be that if you don't know what's going on, you're not going to be very effective at changing it in a direction which is either what you would like to see it be or a direction that would be collectively useful. I mean, useful for the collective of not just human beings, but the larger environmental collectivity that's going on. I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is Roundup and pesticides and bees and things like that. But without going to that specific kind of example, but just in general, Dalai Lama usually begins his talks by saying, everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to be unhappy. But it's pretty amazing what a good job we do of making ourselves unhappy rather than making ourselves happy. So what's that about? Why is that? So here's an example of influencing something that's going on. So, you know, a bunch of people are engaged in behavior, or I am engaged in behavior that's making me unhappy. And what I'd like to do is I would like to do things that make me happy. That's an outcome that I would like to change. So that's an example of something that I think you're talking about, a very specific example. So if I don't understand clearly and correctly why I'm doing what I'm doing and the forces that are at work around me and the forces that are at work within me that are producing my behavior, I'm not going to be able to change the behavior that makes me unhappy so that I start behaving in ways that make me happy. I mean, a real simple example would be if I get angry at my wife, fill in the blank, all the possible reasons, which makes her miserable, that anger is certainly not going to make me happy and it's not going to make her happy. And if my anger is reactive and I can't prevent myself from being angry, then for sure the consequences in our marriage are not very positive. It can be abrasive and negative and whatnot. So I can't do anything about how she behaves. I can't do anything about her actions. She has to do those things. We know that. We've all been married long enough to know. We can't change our spouse. Forget it. The more we try, the worse everything gets, right? So if we look at that situation and we want happiness in our marriage, then what we have to do is figure out, why am I being actively reactive? Why am I being reactive? Why am I being angry about something she's doing? It's not her. It's not about what she's doing. It's about, why am I reacting in that way? If I'm unconscious of it and driven by habit, then I can't do anything about the situation, and the consequences for our marriage will be cumulatively negative. But if I can see why I'm being reactive in that way, then maybe I can do something about it. And I'm going to have to get my thought forms, my habitual thought forms, out of the way to be able to see what's happening. And then to be very specific about this sort of thing, if I look really closely at what's happening and don't listen to what we used to call the tapes that are going on in my head about, well, she did this and that's bad and so on and so forth, if I step back and try and look at what's happening without believing the story that's being told in my head, if I step back and look at it, I'll hear my father's voice. If I'm totally wrapped up in it, I don't hear my father's voice. It's me. If I step back and, okay, my mind is telling this story, this is the story, and I'm just looking at the story instead of reacting and getting angry at Kay, I listen to the story, I hear that the story is being told by my father. It's my father that's angry at Kay. It's not me that's angry at Kay. And when I see that, now I have the opportunity to start to do something about it. But until I see that it's my father and not me, hopeless. It's difficult enough once I see it's my father, but it's hopeless until I see it's my father. So that's, right. My initial training was as a psychologist before I got interested in religions. So my sort of default position when I try to understand things and look for examples of things tends to go back to interpersonal relations and psychodynamics and that kind of thing. But you could have found other examples. Politics would be a great example. We used to have a member of this group who was very active in Hell's Canyon Preservation Council. And he would go to these meetings, and he'd be the environmentalist, and like the farmers would be there, or the ranchers, the loggers. And he'd have to try and get something done. And if he was being reactive in the situation, he couldn't get anything done at all. He said, so he learned some techniques from coming to this group about, you know, stepping back from his own reactivity and watching what was happening and changing motivation and changing attitude and the way he talked about things and trying to engage with people rather than confront. And he became much more effective, you know, in the job. He still got burned out doing the job, but before he got burned out, he was more effective. So that's a more political kind of example. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. It's blind.
Yeah. I mean, because people tend to think about meditation or Buddhism as like, you know, otherworldly. It's like I just disconnect from things and gaze at my navel, as my father used to say, and have a little peace of mind, and it's not relevant to the world. But it is.
I mean,
we talked at the very beginning of this gathering, you know, about how do I relate to people that I work with who are not necessarily always friendly to me. But the long-term consequences of enacting friendliness, no matter what I internally feel, makes it possible for me to continue to work in an environment which is often very hostile. And if I just turn that hostility around, it'd be impossible to work in that environment. You know, So instead of having a few enemies, I'd have everybody who'd be my enemy, because it's like there's that ornery David person again. Let's get him out of here. You know?
And some of the